28th Street. I think I spend more time here than any other store of any type, and it's just great to be back home after a week of book tour and back to be in my, what I consider my own bookstore. You know, I want to introduce my wife who lives down the street, and Maisie and Alex Ains and Paul Ains, my cousins, all of whom have come here to show their support, if not buy a book. And I want to start because I was talking to Brian. I'm going to embarrass him slightly, but he's wearing the black t-shirt there. And he asked me about Einstein as a kid. And Brian told me that, you know, he doesn't read all that well, but he thinks in pictures and is very imaginative. And let me stand up here if I can without causing it to squeak. Nope, that's not going to work. Oh, okay. You turn it down a little and I'll stand up front where I can be more comfortable. Well, if it makes you feel good, Brian, Albert Einstein was really slow in learning how to speak as a child. In fact, he was so slow. Oh.
That's me. How you doing?
I think I'm going to.
That was me. You're fine. I'm sorry.
All right. He was very slow in learning how to speak as a child. In fact, his family maid sort of dubbed him the Derpate, which means the dopey one. And his parents consulted a doctor to see if there was some problem with his language. It's hard for us biographers to try to make long-distance diagnoses and stuff, but I do think that slow language ability was one of the keys to his genius. For example, instead of thinking in words, he always did it in thought pictures. He called them thought experiments. It's what you and I probably call daydreaming. Unless you're an Einstein, you get to call it a thought experiment. And he would marvel at the mundane things, the things that don't usually cause us to be, you know, surprised. For example, when he was just 4 years old, hey Eric, his dad gave him a compass. And he was sick in bed, but he said he got tremors and chills just every time he looked at it, trying to figure out what hidden forces there were in the universe that was causing the needle always to point north. And, you know, you and I can remember getting our first compass, and I'm sure, we said, well, fine, that's kind of cool, and then you move on. It seems mundane. But to Einstein, he said it was my slow learning ability that caused me to marvel even at things like the passage of time, things that most kids don't worry about because they sort of figured out early on. But it took me a long time, and so I would wonder about time and the underlying forces of the universe. He was also quite rebellious, causing one of his headmasters to kick him out of school, another to amuse historians by saying, this Einstein will never amount to much. But I do also think that his rebelliousness, his willingness to defy convention and defy authority, was also one of the causes of his genius. He was the person who, when everybody else would just assume that Newton is right about space being absolute or time tick-tocking along no matter who observes it, he would question every premise and be defiant. He hated watching the Prussian troops march in lockstep. He's growing up in southern Germany. It would make him cry because he said anybody who marches in lockstep, who doesn't rebel every now and then, who isn't imaginative and creative, is never going to learn anything new. So like my friend Benjamin Franklin, he runs away from home as a teenager, runs away from Germany, runs away to Italy and then Switzerland, where he thinks it'll be more free and more open, the type of learning he can get. Now, one of the bad things is that there's a great myth around that Einstein flunked math. And it's a type of myth you really want to have be true, but it isn't, unfortunately. He had trouble, he had trouble with discipline, he had trouble obeying authority, he had trouble with languages, but he didn't have trouble with math. Why? Because as I was saying about Brian, he could picture things. He could picture the underlying meaning of mathematics. For example, even at age 15, he makes his own proof of the Pythagorean theorem, simply by looking at a triangle and then looking at a larger triangle, comparing the two in his mind and knowing why the Pythagorean theorem had to be true. At home, by our daughter Betsy, at one point she was doing some algebra and she had an equation. And she got the answer wrong, and I said, well, just look at it, you can see it's got a slope upward like that. says, what do you mean? I said, well, an equation is simply a brushstroke that the good Lord uses to paint one of the mysteries of nature. It actually has an underlying meaning, just like if you're reading Homer and it says rosy-fingered dawn, you should picture, what is it? What is a rosy-fingered dawn? If you're looking at 2x plus y squared, you should picture it. It curves upward. He said, oh, they never teach us to picture things like that. Einstein, being much smarter than my daughter, at age 16, is looking at Maxwell's equations. Now, Maxwell's equations are a set of equations that describe electromagnetic waves, light beams. And they among the other amazing things they tell you is that a light beam always travels at 186,000 miles per second or so, speed of light, constant. And Einstein is looking at it and saying, I wonder what it would be like if I caught up with a light beam, if I could go the speed of light, and I rode right alongside it, would the wave seem stationary to me? But Maxwell's equations don't allow that. And he said he walked around for days on end with his palms sweaty, worrying about this. And, you know, all of us can remember making our palms sweaty at age 16, and it wasn't Maxwell's equations, but this is him visualizing the math. So despite this brilliance, this runaway tries to get into the Zurich Polytech, which is the second best college in Zurich, and he doesn't get in. He flunks the entrance exam. Not, alas, flunking the math part, but he flunks the language part. On his second try, he finally gets into the Zurich Polytechnic, and he's not a bad student, but he continues to be defiant of authority, a little bit of a rebel, somebody who doesn't just take convention. And in doing so, he's able to tick off all three of his professors. Professor Weber, Heinrich Weber, who is a physics professor there, doesn't even really teach Maxwell's equations because they're too newfangled, you know, for old Professor Weber. So Einstein quits calling him Herr Professor, which is a polite way to address him, and starts calling him Herr Weber, Mr. Weber. And Weber gets so outraged by this that he basically cuts off Einstein. There's a professor named Pernay who is the laboratory instructor. Einstein was never a good experimentalist. That's why he had to become a theorist. But he goes into the experimental labs of Pernay. Pernay at one point gave him a sheet, gave them all a sheet of how to do an experiment. Einstein crumples it up defiantly, you know, makes a show of it, throws it away and does the experiment his own way, and of course it blows up. Cuts his hand, he has to have stitches. Pernay puts him on academic probation. And finally, there's Minkowski, the math teacher. Einstein doesn't go to math class, thinks math is unnecessary if you're going to be a great physicist. He's wrong. Has a friend, Marcel Grossman, who takes notes for him. And Minkowski ends up pronouncing Einstein a lazy dog. So he is the only graduate, Einstein's the only graduate of his year at the Zurich Polytech in the physics or math or anything else who can't get a job. He can't get an assistant professorship, a teaching fellowship, he can't get a doctoral fellowship. He can't even get a job teaching high school. He applies all over Germany, Italy, and Switzerland for high school teacherships, cannot get a job because all of his professors, especially Professor Weber, keep giving him bad recommendations. Eventually, Grossman, the guy who took notes for him in math class, Grossman's father helps him get a job at the Swiss Patent Office in Bern, Switzerland, as a third-class examiner, sitting on a stool in the Swiss Patent Office. Third-class examiner because he couldn't be a second-class examiner because he hadn't gotten his doctorate yet. His doctoral dissertations keep getting rejected by these professors. So he's sitting on a stool working 6 days a week, examining patent applications and trying to write physics on the side. But lest we feel sorry for him, I'm convinced that, like his slow learning ability in some ways, that being forced to be in the patent office truly helps him. What they're doing in the patent office at this time is Switzerland has just gone to synchronized time zones or standard time zones. And the Swiss, being Swiss, are obsessive about getting the clocks synchronized. So they come up with at least 70 different patent applications over the 1902 to 1905 period. It's for ways to synchronize clocks. And there's one thing they all have in common, of course, if you think about it, is they use a signal. And that signal travels at the speed of light. It's either a telegraph signal, or an electrical signal, or a light signal, or a radio signal, but they travel at the speed of light. And so there are different ways, so when it strikes 7 in Zurich, it'll strike 7 at the wonderful clock tower outside of Einstein's window in Bern, Switzerland. It's in the book, the picture of it, some of you may have seen, an 11th century clock tower, absolutely gorgeous. And Einstein passes it every day, and so do all the trains going into the Bern train station where all the clocks are synchronized. So during that time, Einstein is in his spare time with his indulgent boss, who's told him to question every premise he ever sees, and turning a blind eye as Einstein's writing these papers and slipping them in a drawer whenever the boss walks by. Einstein starts writing some papers, and one of his friends goes away, and so we have the best letter in the history of all of physics to a guy named Conrad Habicht, and it's an impudent letter that's sort of nasty and impertinent. It starts, "You frozen whale, you canned piece of soul, you didn't send me your doctoral dissertation, you better send it to me, and until then I'm only going to write you a letter of inconsequential babble. But if you send me your doctoral dissertation, I'll send you four papers. I promise you four papers," he says. The next paragraph describes the four papers, and you realize, oh, this is not inconsequential babble. It's the most interesting tidings in the history of science. He says, the first paper is quite revolutionary, and it deals with the radiation and light. And indeed, it's revolutionary. It says light is not just a wave, but Einstein figures out light is actually a particle as well. The quantum theory, quanta theory of light. He says, the second determines the true sizes of atoms and molecules by using a sugar diffusion. Now, most professors then did not even believe atoms and molecules really existed, but Einstein realizes that this is the simplest and safest of his papers for his latest attempt to get a doctoral dissertation accepted. So he sends this one in for a doctoral dissertation. The third one does Brownian motion, which is why little particles jangle in water. And then he says the fourth is only a very rough draft at this point, but it does involve a modification of the theory of space and time. You go, wow, that's not inconsequential babble. And of course, that's special relativity. What he doesn't tell Conrad is that right after he finishes the draft and finishes that paper, he goes away, and a week later, a thought occurs to him, and he writes a very short addendum that's published separately, a little three-page addendum to that fourth paper, which he says, and if all this is true, this special relativity and light as quanta, then there's a relationship between energy and mass that involves the speed of light. And he says, and you can express it, and it's E equals mc squared, the most famous equation of all of physics. Now, helping him with these papers is a very interesting woman, Mileva Maric. Mileva Maric was a Serbian mathematician and physicist, a woman who had, whose father, who was a soldier, had helped her force her way into the all-male Zagreb Academy, moving up in the world of physics, which was, of course, back then, and to some extent, as Larry Summers would tell us even now, male-dominated. She becomes the only woman at the Zurich Polytechnic studying physics and math, and of course, she falls madly in love with Einstein, he falls madly in love with her. The letters that have just been released are truly astonishing, and they're romantic letters and the pillows on fire and all the things that happen. They take a trip around Lake Como in a horse-drawn carriage in the spring, go hiking around, she ends up pregnant, they have a little illegitimate daughter, a mysterious daughter, because she's left for adoption for a while back in Serbia, and you have to read the book to find out what may or may not have happened to her. They can't get married because Einstein can't get a job. This is after college. Finally, when he does get the job in the patent office, they get married. They have two more children. She helps with the 1905 papers. Great controversy of how much she helps, which I go into in the book. I think she does a lot of help with the math, but the concepts are his. But eventually, they're very different personalities. They start drifting apart. It becomes it's always a tempestuous relationship, but it becomes tempestuous bad, not just tempestuous good. They want a divorce. Einstein can't afford a divorce. He has very little money. And so he offers her a deal. He says, one of these days, one of those papers will win the Nobel Prize. If you give me a divorce, you will get the money. Now, she's smart. She's a scientist. She takes a week. She calculates the odds. She consults with a guy named Fritz Haber, who was a physical chemist. She consults with a lawyer. She draws up a contract. They go back and forth, and she takes the bet. It's not until 1922 that they finally announce that he wins the Nobel Prize, 17 years after those papers are written. But she gets all the money, and she buys three apartment buildings in Zurich. In the meantime, Einstein's finally gotten a job in Berlin. The letters are pretty interesting because fighting with his first wife, Mileva, the kids are back in Switzerland. Even things, you know, you in some ways it's agonizing, but it also says, oh yeah, this is a human being. There's one set of letters where he's actually trying to do general relativity, and in between, Mileva has bought skis for 70 francs for Hans Albert, the oldest son, but told Hans Albert, who's 11, you have to write a letter to your dad and make him pay for the skis. And Einstein is writing back, right in the middle of this, anticipating World War I happening and stuff, saying, that's ridiculous, I'm not paying for those skis, it's too much of a luxury. And you think, well, that's cold and heartless, but you also think, okay, here's a human being having fights with his kids, then finally he promises to come down and see the kid, doesn't come down at Christmas because he's still trying to do general relativity. When he finally gets it done, he comes down for Easter, there's reconciliation. In the meantime, he's marrying his first cousin who's nursing him because during World War I, she's the only one who could help him get food. It's a truly amazing personal existence. And as I said, he's trying to get the general theory of relativity while this is happening. The general theory of relativity is probably the grandest, most elegant, astonishing theories in the history of science.